But Ralph, if you feel that the electromagnetic field is inadequate to what Rupert's asking of it, then you must be equally skeptical of the morphogenetic field. It sounds to me like what you're saying.
No, I'm not skeptical. I think that what we're trying to do is do the revision of the actual phenomenon of life, of our experience, to make up a model for some of the phenomenon, which now modelers, I mean scientists, prefer to totally ignore. And the electromagnetic field and its history as a modeling effort, you know, its hermeneutical history is an excellent history to imitate. And that what we must do is try to fashion a field concept around the phenomena that have been ignored. And it does seem very attractive to think of the electromagnetic field as some kind of favored intermediary among all the physical fields. Well, let's just put it this way, that the perhaps the M field, or the mind of the world, the Oversoul or whatever, will end up with a mathematical model which is simply field theoretic, maybe with many dimensions, and that is coupled only to the electromagnetic field. And the electromagnetic field, of course, is coupled to all the other physical fields, and through that intermediary. So this is a combination model, a sandwich model, which might be successful in explaining perception, cognition, idiosyncrasies of time, and that there would be sort of eventually a general relativity theory for the M field, which would explain time anomalies like clairvoyance and so on. And in that case, I think what we're talking about now is the conception, the struggle to envision the coupling between the M field and the electromagnetic field, including wave metaphors, particle metaphors, and so on. That's kind of what it's about, at least Model 1 you described at the beginning explicitly in these terms.
That's right. Well, my first model, you see, has always been that the perception and mental activity must have a kind of field-like structure. They'd be morphic fields of some kind. These perceptual fields are in turn part of these behavioral fields, which involve action as well as perception. Perception and the action are linked together. It's not motiveless perception that one's usually carrying out. It's linked in some way to action. Bergson said all perceptions are potential actions, or possible actions. There's a sense in which they're very closely related. So this was my first model, and I thought of the sense of being stared at as a way of testing for the existence of this other kind of field. It then occurred to me that there's this mystery of light. I still think, you see, that Maxwell's electromagnetic formulations of light are much too simple. You see, whereas you were saying the model of the brain to get the complexity out of it that's in it would have to be more complex than his equations, that's obviously true. But when I'm seeing you, all the information about you, everything that's transferred to me through my vision, is coming through the electromagnetic field. And Maxwell's equation couldn't...
Well, is it? I mean, are we not then buying the oversimplification of the physicist in assuming that? Why not have a full mental wave traveling from my mental being to yours as a wave phenomenon or a particle phenomenon, resonance phenomenon that takes place in the mental field alone.
Plus the existing cloud of pheromones that are also transducing information.
Yes, but in parenthesis about the pheromones, this staring at test can exclude those by being done through double glazed glass windows.
But in fact, in all cases when it's been done that we're aware of, hasn't the possibility that the pheromone was carrying the effect been...
It's been done through windows. One of the most common anecdotal sources of this is people who tell me that when in traffic jams, they're stuck in traffic jams or at traffic lights with the windows rolled up, you know, and the air conditioning on in the winter. They look at the back of the neck of women in other cars who turn round. I mean, there are a lot of men who find this a favourite pursuit at traffic lights. I've had many anecdotes told me of this kind. And that's through two lots of glass.
No, that's pretty good.
So I think that...
No, but even if you could handle this, if you could explain this with pheromones, that means that I would have to have the capability to focus my pheromones on a single person with mental power alone, or visual, or looking, or whatever it is. So
it's not a very good hypothesis. Anyway, I think it could be empirically excluded at a very early stage through these glass partition. So back to the physical, the electromagnetic field. If one wanted to model the information coming, you know, through, if one did want to model it properly, how I could see you through the electromagnetic field, you'd need more than Maxwell's equations.
Yes.
And the thing is that the way we treat light is we take for granted the information that travels through it. Virtually everything we read is going through the electromagnetic field. All the information in libraries we access through it. I mean, this, all the everything that human knowledge is capable of in a stored or written form is mediated through it.
We'd be in a pickle without light.
And so Maxwell's equation does seem a little simple to model the transfer of the entire stock of human knowledge.
Well, we've come to the crux of the problem, because Maxwell's equations was made up to model the observables, and it did a really good job. And here we're kind of stuck for lack of observables, in spite of this anecdotal evidence, which to me has the same force as a report from the Argonne National Laboratory. Nevertheless, I think that we ought to think about the possibility that this effect will not be confirmed in laboratories, which is already the experience of so many experimental efforts over these years with the cards and so on to confirm the so-called paranormal. Whereas there is evidence, it always seems to be just the slightest bulge of the curve to the right or left of the absolutely insignificant result, that these phenomena that we want to capture in a model don't seem to be very robust, and they come and go because due to the fact perhaps that they live primarily in the mental field, they're very subject to the noise, the heat bath in the mental field, which maybe all the time I'm trying to get the person to turn, somebody else somewhere is trying to get them not to turn, or they're trying to get somebody else to turn. I mean, I don't know. For whatever reason, these effects are very difficult to confirm, and I'm thinking of that as being a kind of evidence in itself, that on the one hand we have the very widespread impression that these things exist on behalf of many people, dowsing and so on, and on the other hand the impossibility to confirm them in the experimental paradigm of modern science. That somehow this is just suggesting to me the necessity for a thicker model, a richer field in which to try to do the modeling, where there's just chaotic attractors everywhere and no homeostasis or anything like that.
Well, yes, I agree we need a thicker field to deal with most of these parapsychological phenomena. I suspect the sense of being stared at may be different under laboratory tests. You see, whereas the others have proved evanescent and hard to pin down, it's not that this has proved like that, it's that this is something that parapsychologists, for some mysterious reason, have assiduously ignored. And there literally are three published papers in the literature, and I gave a lecture on this 3 or 4 months ago to the Society for Psychical Research. I gave a lecture called The Sense of Being Stared At. And there all the veterans of the British Society for Psychical Research were present, you know, ghost investigators of yesteryear and hardened experimentalists and so on.
Ectoplasma nuts.
Yes. You know, veterans of many seances and so on. They were all there. And all the luminaries of the society. And not one of them had ever thought of this as a paranormal or psychical phenomenon. After 50 years of psychical research, they told me so afterwards. They were fascinated by the lecture because, in a sense, this really has been a blind spot of parapsychology. And if you look through any textbook on parapsychology, there's nothing, no mention of the sense of being stared at.
Well, will this result in some new experiments then, or what must we do to stimulate some research?
Well, I'm working on it. First of all, I've decided that I've got to try and train myself. I've got this biofeedback training system for this. You have two people. One sits with their back to the other. The other tosses a coin. If it's heads, you stare at them. If it's tails, you look away and think of something else. And so you make a click when you've done the coin, you're ready to stare. If it's heads, you then stare. And the other person from the click knows the trial's begun. And then they say yes or no, depending if they think they're being stared at. And they're right or wrong. You record the result. And then you tell them, correct or incorrect. So there's instant, like, biofeedback. And one can train oneself to test various subtle, I've done hundreds of trials of this, test various subtle sensations. And you, And the interesting thing is that most people are more often right when they are being looked at than when they're not. But the reason I wanted to discuss this in the first place is that I actually don't know which to think. I don't know whether it's better to adopt the electromagnetic hypothesis, which has certain has the attraction of giving another side to the phenomenon of light, which most people think is just physical and it's all in textbooks. Because I think light's far more mysterious than that. And it also, that's one advantage. The second is that it then takes us into a whole other area, which is that this metaphorical use of words like the light of consciousness and the fact that when we dream, we see things in a kind of light. We do have a kind of inner light, which illuminates psychedelic visions, dreams, daydreams, visual images with your eyes closed. There's some sense in which our imagination, our image-making facility is self-luminous. Now, is that kind of light, if understanding or perception, if vision, is related to normal physical light, here we may have something where the physical light comes first and vision comes second when we're looking at somebody. You know, if you turn the light off, you don't see them. But in this other case, it may be the other way around, and their relationship may be expressed in the reverse sense. Yes. That if you have vision, in the visionary sense of vision, that vision may itself generate light through an association between vision and light, so that at least subjectively they're self-luminous. And then if somebody has visions enough, according to all traditions, they start developing halos and their bodies actually become luminous, according to mystical and spiritual traditions.
It's interesting, according to one school of pharmacologists, attention is the thing they most suspect being mediated by DMT, because DMT is so quickly able to be brought forth and degraded. It's very has a fast reaction time, which is exactly what you need in a system where you're going to throw attention first from one object to another. And these tryptamine hallucinogens certainly fill the head with light. I mean, if you take the intensity of the visionary experience as an index of the intensity of inner light, then they release this, and their near relatives in brain chemistry, serotonin is transduced to melatonin by a light-mediated reaction. In other words, light actually enters through the eyes, and a part of the visual pathway breaks off and goes to the pineal gland, where photons work a chemical change on serotonin and turn it into melatonin. So the tryptamines, their near relatives, all this stuff is going on in the pineal, and it's all light-driven chemistry.
Nevertheless, it seems that this kind of vision has nothing to do with light, with the electromagnetic field. So even though these neurotransmitters are very photosensitive, the fact is that in the dark you have very bright visions, so that the neurochemical activity in the visual cortex or somewhere is, as it were, mimicking the effect of the photons falling upon the visual on the retina, producing a chemical wave, etc. So in the alternation many times back and forth between electromagnetic and chemical waves in neurophysiological level, these psychedelics, for example, are taking over at some point and supplying what appears to be the result of the previous train of several reversals. So this illumination on that level, actually, the photons can be replaced, as it were, by this other messenger.
Well, it's interesting, this business of light. I've probably tried this out on you in the past, Ralph, but one of my cosmological fantasies of years past was, you know, there's this curious problem with the fact that the photon has no antiparticle. It's the only particle without an antiparticle, and this is a really sort of disturbing asymmetry in things. And
So, who preceded me in this? I think Hans Alvin, this Swedish cosmologist, he suggested that at the Big Bang, the reason there is such a low incidence of antimatter in this region of the universe is that actually the Big Bang was not a spurting of matter into the continuum, but that it went in two directions and out of a single point, like a double jet, and two bubbles were blown at once, in other words, and we are in one universe with a very high proportion of matter versus antimatter, and there is a twin of
the
our
universe,
the anti-universe, and we cannot detect it or see it or transmit information between ourselves and it in any way. And in this anti-universe, every particle's antiparticle exists. Well, in a higher dimensional manifold, these things have gone off into the great void, but they are actually on a collision trajectory of such a nature that after a certain amount of time, they will re-encounter each other. And when this happens, because it's happening in a higher dimension, it isn't like a collision of two solid objects. It's more like the sudden, instantaneous superimposition of two objects, so that this cosmic collision, if you will, could actually occur across the entire face of the topological manifold instantly. It would be as though every particle in the universe underwent collision with its antiparticle at the exact same moment.
Three-dimensional blackout.
Yes, and at that moment, parity would be conserved. All particles in the universe would cease to exist except the anomalous photon, which would be in this moment in which all the rest of matter disappeared, the photons would then be left to obey the physics of a universe made entirely of photons. And what this would be, we can't say, but the form would be preserved in that final moment. All form would be turned to light. And
the body of the cosmos.
Yes, and so since tradition is so keen on resolving things into light, and what's also amusing about this kind of cosmology is that it's a totally apocalyptic cosmology. There would be no warning. This collision with the antimatter twin could occur in at any moment.
Another vision of the end. Terence McCoy.
Of cosmologies, there is no end.
And of apocalypses, there is no end.
I think it might be useful, Rupert, to think about the habits of electromagnetic nature and the behavior of the electromagnetic field as according to evolving according to habits of the morphogenetic field, explaining in this way the resonance between them, as above so below, that the M field has created the EM field to do its bidding in the quantum matter level.
Well, certainly, you see, if the electromagnetic field, it is the bearer of all visual information in the world. I mean, of everything we see, of everything in every book, in every diagram. Now, this brings me to another fantasy or idea, as the electromagnetic field is an interface not just between the matter fields in us and the mental aspects or psychic or morphic aspects of our being, but also the electromagnetic field is playing a similar role in the mental structure of the soul of the world. You see, if the soul of the world, if there is a world soul which permeates the entire cosmos, which in its bodily level is mostly expressed in the gravitational field, but which at its sort of knowing or psychic or perceptual level is mainly expressed through some kind of interface with the electromagnetic field, the electromagnetic field would be a perfect medium for the world soul's omniscience, and then through the world soul for divine omniscience, because nothing that happens doesn't affect the electromagnetic field. The holographic reality of the electromagnetic field at any one moment is what's happening. At least it's in exact correspondence with what's happening. And so all the light in the universe, including this kind of cross currents of memory that would be set up, for example, by the continued presence of the cosmic microwave background radiation, the fossil light of the Big Bang, it's still there as a kind of background. So there'd be even a kind of light memory built into the whole universe. So this similar model, you see, gives us the universal electromagnetic field as the universal basis of the world soul, as of its knowing or perception or interfacing with other planes of reality, and as a medium of divine omniscience.
Well, I like the idea of the electromagnetic field being the chosen representative, the ideal intermediary that is positioned in the hierarchy of fields. In that way, its position in the hierarchy of fields is very much as the position of our individual consciousness in the hierarchy of consciousness in the world soul. And therefore we have in our individual consciousness a particular affinity with the electromagnetic field, with electromagnetic perception, reception, and so on, as epitomized by vision. And if this fantasy has any reality, then it seems like it should be easier if there would be phenomenon of mental effect of the action of mind over matter. Then the easiest thing to affect should be the electromagnetic field. As in, dowsing is a sensitivity, direct sensitivity to magnetic field. Then you'd wonder, is it easy to, for example, to mentally influence a magnetometer?
Let me tell you one fantasy I've had for an experiment of this kind. You know those puzzle pictures that I did experiments with? You know, you have those black and white blotches. Did you see those ones I used in my experiments? When you recognize it, there's a visual gestalt is set up. You see the man on the horseback against the pattern of blobs, and you now see it differently. So if there's anything in this sort of thing coming out as well as coming in, when you look at that picture of black and white blotches, knowing what it is, as opposed to scanning helplessly for trying to find what it is, you should be seeing it differently. And in particular, where the lines, the outlines of the horse are, which you sort of fill in mentally, those lines should be reinforced as above other parts of it. Now, if this picture were produced by means of a liquid crystal display or something of that kind, where you could actually, were full of sort of probabilistic processes that could actually be monitored in some way, I'm not quite sure how to do the technology of this, but some probabilistic light-sensitive processes that were built into this picture that you're looking at, the little units, it might be possible to pick up when you explain to somebody, you have somebody look at it, you then show them the answer and they look at it again, and the pattern of output from this thing, as these pattern of probabilisms, may change because it may be less random now that certain lines and directions have been recognized and reinforced. And that might be a way, if one could possibly design the sensor side of this apparatus, it's a matter of finding something that's probabilistic. I would imagine that in the photographic film, whether the silver grains go or not is probabilistic. Except with high light intensity, they'd all go very fast. But I should imagine with very low light intensity, it must be probabilistic. So one could possibly do it with some kind of suitably fine grain photo emulsion thing where one has a light intensity where it's a probabilistic matter whether you get the thing going over the edge or not. Do you see what I mean? Some experiment of that kind, some
maybe
sensor.
A computer terminal or a photoluminescent screen, there might be a way to affect it by looking that someone else could see.
That's right. If it's a photoluminescent screen that's working probabilistically at a low level of intensity, you might be able to get a kind of enhancement of the luminescences along the outline, as it were. Just one more word on divine omniscience. You see, it seems to me that any theology of divine omniscience would require any all-knowing mind, any theory of any omniscience, whether it's the world soul as an intermediary or God directly or the goddess or any form of omniscience, would require the divine mind to know everything And since knowing everything would include knowing all the properties and states of the electromagnetic and the gravitational fields, one can be pretty sure that what's going on in those fields is essential to divine omniscience, just on general principles. But the usual model I've found when people think about divine omniscience is to think of it as an entirely miraculous process, totally disconnected from any kind of physical reality, somehow standing outside it. Yet, any reflection on the subject would show that that divine omniscience must involve not just sort of somehow standing outside all things, but in some sense being immanent within them as well, knowing from within, it's not just seeing from outside. And therefore must, in some sense, pervade the electromagnetic field. Just as Newton thought the medium of divine omniscience was space, absolute space, which he called the sensorium of God. Everything happens in space, and therefore if space is the sensorium of God, everything happens in God's sensorium, and God therefore knows where everything is and how fast it's moving.
Why is divine omniscience a necessary concept?
We need a little primer on divine omniscience.
I mean, can't the universe get along just being partially aware of what's going on?
Well, it depends whether you think there's any... There are a lot of people who think that if they're pantheists, they think that the universe is in some sense conscious, or the soul of the world in some sense is perceiving what's going on, not just entirely unconscious. And there are many theological traditions of divine omniscience. There are a lot of people who've got a stake in cosmic omniscience. I'm just stating this as a sociological fact.
And what is so good about it?
Well, that there's a lot to be said for models of reality. They're very popular, and I think that they're intriguing to think of models of reality in which there is a knowing, a sense of knowing associated with the cosmos. I mean, it's in
but
so
that,
many religions.
Isn't that different from, I mean, divine omniscience? We all have a sense of knowing, but we're not omniscient.
No.
What problems are solved by hypothesizing that notion?
It's to do with the question of the nature of our own minds. You see, there are two possible models. One is that our minds are the most advanced in the universe, and that's the standard model of secular humanism, that the rest of the universe is essentially unconscious, and that living organisms crawled out of the primal broth and then through the miracles of random mutation and neo-Darwinian natural selection gave rise to organisms such as ourselves with complex nervous systems that happen to have this interesting subjective correlate of consciousness. And this consciousness we have is emerged out of the darkness of the earth and the darkness of the universe and is the highest consciousness there is. That's dogs and cats, you know, may be a little way towards us, and it's conceivable intelligent beings exist on other planets, but basically this is it. That's the one model. The other model, the more traditional one, is to derive human consciousness from a much larger consciousness, which pervades the cosmos, pervades the Earth, pervades the whole of life on Earth, and that our consciousness has arisen by a kind of diminution or descent of some higher kind of consciousness rather than ascent from a lower and finally from a non-existent kind of consciousness, that we're a reduced version, a self-contracted version of a higher consciousness rather than an inflated version of a lower one or none at all. That's
our
metaphysical background. I find it more reasonable to suppose that our minds are in touch with larger minds and in many ways shaped with larger mental systems, those of whole societies, the ecosystems, Gaia, the galaxy, the entire cosmos, and maybe a cosmic mind beyond that, or a universal. I think it more reasonable to think that our minds...
Well, I can go as far as a Gaian mind, because it seems a biological object, not a theological hypostatization. The mind of the whole universe, it seems unnecessary to hypothesize and unlikely to be encountered.
It's no problem. Suppose there was another Gaia, another inhabited planet. Then it will have its own Gaian mind.
And they will be citizens of the universe even as we are.
And between our Gaian mind and theirs, there might be a dialogue in progress.
Yes, but nothing of this suggests theology. This is just
no,
exotic biology.
We just projected theology onto it as an association with phrase divine omniscience, which is usually associated with Yahweh, the one God, and his divine omniscience. That is unnecessary to make that association. As soon as you have gone as far as the guy in mind, you can certainly go further, as there is obviously a hierarchy of worlds up into the universe, as it were.
Yes, although I'm not convinced that the hierarchy is minded at every level. The universe
right.
is obviously
That's
a
the question.
Hierarchy, but
yes.
if there were simply...
Does Jupiter have a Jupiterian mind?
Well, possibly,
Sun
but a stranger
a solar
question
mind.
Is, does the solar system have a mind? I think that's a sort of silly...
No, reach your limit. That's
no.
the interface to discuss then.
No, yes, I think that's the interface, you see, because for me it seems entirely natural to suppose, on any holistic model of reality, that if Gaia has a kind of mind, the soul of the Earth, then the Gaian mind would be embedded in the solar system mind, and that in the galactic mind. And that these higher levels of mind, consciousness, being, which may be hard to conceive by us, are very likely to exist by a simple logical argument. I don't think that...
Not necessarily in a hierarchical order. I mean, chipmunks are not small portions of whales.
No. But chipmunks are not inside whales. Chipmunks are inside sort of... terrestrial ecosystems. They're small portions of terrestrial ecosystems. Whales are in different ecosystems, and both these, the oceanic and the terrestrial ecosystems, are part of the Gaia.
Mm-hmm.
So the hierarchy is of more inclusive units. The solar system is not on the same level as the Earth. It's a higher level of organization of which the Earth is part. The galaxy is a higher level of which the solar system is part.
So we need to decide whether we can have any interest in a lunar mind or not, or a solar mind.
I think it's an Earth-lunar mind.
Yes, I think the Moon's part of the Earth as a system. It orbits the Earth. It's in its gravitational
field. It's in our blood.
It causes our time.
If you accept Gaian mind, do you think there's a similar kind of mind associated with Jupiter?
Yes, I think
without
planets
having
are animals.
Primates and so
yes,
on running
planets
around.
Planets are like animals. But I don't believe that. I think that
then there's a mental ecosystem of our solar system, which is the solar mind. Now we've got to there.
And
but
that,
that's
so in astrology, you see,
that's
an
island.
Important.
Sure.
It's the movement.
Now,
it's
now
an
we've
organism.
Got your limit. But a minute ago it was the guy in mind. Now we've boosted you without rockets. To the
certain
solar mind.
Other places in the solar system seem potentially open to the support of recognizable forms of life, the oceans of Europa.
No, but does it need recognizable life to have a mind? You see, in the Gaian mind, it is not only the so-called living beings in it, microbes included, that have mind. Right? The ecosystem is a mind.
Well, but
and
you
the
don't
Gaian
want
mind
to define mind so broadly that it's no longer recognizable as what we say when we ordinarily use the
no,
word
that's
mind.
The problem, I think so.
Well,
I
we don't know
Gaian
what we do
system
use.
The system as described by you yesterday beautifully as this system of control, self-control, interpenetrating, holistic system, that this the functions of all these different components of the complex system appear to think. I mean, they fit exactly our model of thinking. Now, to ask if it's conscious or unconscious is different question, I think, which very much complicates the issue due to the fact that we have consciousness and unconsciousness.
Oh, well, I'm definitely into the notion that if you can't have an I-thou relationship with it, it's fairly uninteresting to call it a mind.
Well, do you think that the Gaian mind would then be dead if the human species became extinct?
No, any more than anyone else is dead if an acquaintance dies. I communicate with the guy
so,
in mind.
Then why can't Jupiter have a Jupiterian mind without the necessity of microbes?
Oh, I grant that. It's these more diffuse abiological systems.
Well, no, who said that? If Jupiter has one, the Sun...
The Sun is a hard step to take.
Well, this is one we discussed the other day. If
right.
the Sun indeed is a very complex resonant pattern of magnetic field.
It has neurons.
With little sort of cells and vortices throughout its whole surface. The whole thing with very complex resonant patterns, as has recently been shown, with complete magnetic polar reversals every 11 years, starting at sunspot maxima, and longer periods of resonance too, a very complex system of highly probabilistic turbulences, resonances, and so on. There's a physical interface if a mind has to have a physical interface, then there's a pretty good one for the sun. And the solar system as a whole involves all the what's going on in all the planets, all the gravitational interactions, the electromagnetic field of the sun in which everything is made manifest. The electromagnetic field of the sun includes us sitting here in this room, everything that's illuminated. And if there's some kind of associated mind with the light, which is one of the things we started off knowing, the solar mind, which is the source of the light, directly and indirectly, of everything that we see, is in a sense we're in it. We're in that solar. The light is coming from the sun, and in a sense we're in it. So we may be, all things may be seen by the sun. The sun is often in many cultures called an eye in the sky, and on the dollar bill, that eye of Horus, which is in the triangle there, but it's the radiant eye, it's the sun, it's not only the seer but the emitter of light,
mm-hmm.
which brings us back to the sort of theme from which we started, the connection between light and vision. And if the sun has both this inner dynamics plus is the field of which all things in the solar system are seen and related, plus is related to them all through the gravitational field, we've got galaxies, clusters, and
yes,
the cosmos.
Yes, there's no doubt that we can jack him up the rest of the way.
But where is
the problem has to do with divine
omniscience. Divine omniscience.
That's more difficult.
It certainly
that
is.
Put you off. That's you should.
Because it implies a kind of knowing that is never met with.
Well, that's surely implicit in the very concept of divine omniscience. Any notion that our consciousness is less than higher forms of consciousness implies there must be forms of knowing that we don't meet with.
Omniscience is a kind of mathematical notion, not something you could expect any biological system to attain. Biological systems just get, sentience, and then a little more, and a little more, and then a lot. But divine omniscience is like mathematical absolute. It means certain knowledge of everything. That's some program.
Well, I just was suggesting the simple thought that conceive for the purpose of argument that there's some kind of sense of knowing associated with the electromagnetic field.
But
then would that not amount to complete knowledge of everything in the physical level?
Well,
does it include knowledge of the future?
I'm talking now about perceptual knowledge of the present. I mean, my discussion has been entirely centered on omniscience of the present. I'm not now thinking of future knowledge of the future.
That's a separate question.
Although this is the Laplacian thing, wasn't it? If you knew the initial positions, i.e. in the present, this divinely omniscient mind could calculate all future.
Well, yes, that's
Laplace,
but that was in a deterministic universe where the God was modeled on Laplace.
Uh-huh.
But what I'm talking about is divine omnipercipience, let's say, omniperception. That if there were a mind associated with the electromagnetic and the gravitational fields, the positions and everything that's happening in the universe would be known to it, not through some kind of external mind looking and examining it, because this knowing would pervade these fields. There'd be nothing in the universe outside them, on the physical level.
True, although within my own body I have very little understanding of what's going on.
Well, the divine omniscience may be, it may be as unconscious as your omniscience of what's going on in your body. What you need to know in your body is when something alters.
Right.
And if you had a pinprick, you'd instantly know it. But you'd know it by contrast with the non-pinprick state, because your present state is different from being asleep or
you might not
unconscious or comatose.
The fact is that our mind is primarily unconscious. Mm-hmm. And consciousness is not a necessary consideration of omniscience. And it's, I think, a major fallacy of the modern system is to emphasize the grandeur of consciousness. To imagine that our mind is primarily conscious is just to deny the existence of the unconscious, which is part of the rational approach, is to the denial of the irrational. The fact is that consciousness is a drop on the bucket of the individual mind. And it could be that the guy in mind is completely unconscious, and that wouldn't matter at all. I think that it still functions as a mental being, and that even the concept of consciousness is inappropriate for the world soul, the cosmic mind, and so on. It's just not an appropriate concept. There's no need to project that little tiny self-reflection aspect of our own being onto the cosmic mind. It's unnecessary. One could discuss that at a future time.
Yeah, what do you think about that?
Well, I think that the cosmic mind may be largely unconscious, because I think that most things that happen in the cosmos are habitual and therefore unconscious. But there's a curious kind of consciousness or awareness associated with habituation. I mean, all sensory modes that we know of work on the principle of difference. What you detect are not fixed levels, like when you're sitting on a cushion, you're not sensing the pressure on your bottom. You habituate. And even in the simplest organisms, habituation is the first form of learning. It's the ability to sort of filter out or become unconscious of everything that's habitual in the environment.
Mm-hmm.
The way consciousness
novelty
works...
Novelty is the big thing.
Yes, what attracts attention is novelty. Anything new in the environment immediately attracts the attention of a person, an animal, or anything. And they usually react with fear, then followed by approach and curiosity, and then if it's harmless, it's just accepts and ignores. This pattern shown by pet dogs. It's
regular Bateson's theory of information.
So it's the difference that makes a difference. I mean, this is standard sensory physiology. It's not just Bateson's, that sensory systems work on differences. And sensory perceptions are all based on differences. So you become sensory aware if you're just staring vacantly at a whole area of what we call the visual field, appropriately enough. You don't notice anything particular. As soon as there's any motion in it, your eye immediately battens onto the moving object. And that's because it's a difference. So this is the way our senses work. Now, I think that if there were to be something like the Gaian mind or the mind of the solar system or even the galactic mind, that it would probably work in a similar way. Be habituated to anything that stays the same or follows regular cycles. But it may be that consciousness would flare up, as it were, or become associated with anything that challenge, crisis, problem, pain, or anything that makes, or any new thing that makes a difference. There might be a kind of rising of awareness about that in the Gaian mind. There might be, against a large background of unconsciousness, which is the way...
What you're saying is novelty would drive it.
Novelty would drive it. And it would be driven by, and also discomfort, because there's certain kinds of pain that we have that persist
mm-hmm.
and act as motivations for our behavior. And I think there'd have to be some kind of...
So disequilibrium would drive it.
Yes.
That's a better term.
Yes. So there'd be disequilibrium and novelty. I mean, there'd be a variety of things that would drive it. But the reason I think that this is a reasonable view is that we see the same pattern not just in our own minds, but this thing of sensory differences and habituation right back to unicellular organisms and plants. And it seems to be a kind of universal mode of awareness, or at least of sensory awareness. And since we're talking about perceptual, the perception of the world soul, as it were, its sense, if the electromagnetic field is, as it were, its sense organ or a part of its sensory system, then something of this kind would apply.
We're talking about reductionist Gaian psychology.
Well, it's not just reductionist Gaian psychology. I mean, the electromagnetic field is only part of this, just as the electromagnetic changes in our brains are only part of the brain.
Well, it's valuable to parse the system into parts without necessarily reducing it to its sum of its parts.
We're talking at the moment, anyway, only about Gaian perception, not about Gaian understanding, nor about Gaian hopes, fears, and
conscious dreams,
and goals, and nor about Gaian dreams, nor about Gaian daydreams, nor about Gaian memories. So there's much more to the Gaian mind than its perceptual mode of knowing what's going on now. And light is just one of the aspects of that perceptual mode, as it's just one of the aspects through which we know the world around us. But somehow, the light and what happens in the light has to be related to our vision. And so the question is, First, this question of our own vision, how it's related to light.
Gaian vision.
And then how Gaian vision or other forms of vision are related to it.
Yes. So, we're on the track of a cognitive map of the Gaian mind. That seems to be the appropriate level. We've tried smaller, we've tried larger. That feels comfortable this year.
Yes, that's right.
Yes.
A cognitive map of the Gaian mind.